Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Political Science, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Lemis Abdelati from the Maxwell School of Syracuse University. Today, I'll be talking to Erin Snyder about her book, Marketing Democracy, The Political Economy of Democracy Aid in the Middle East. This book was published by Cambridge University Press in 2022. It challenges us to think critically about the effectiveness of democracy aid and how democracy promotion programs are designed. Erin, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
So I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us just a bit about yourself.
Sure. So I'm currently an assistant professor of international affairs at Texas A&M University's Bush School of Government and Public Service, where most of my research and teaching focuses on the political economy of development in the Middle East, the politics of democracy assistance, and foreign aid.
Well, it's wonderful to have you on the show. So how did you come to write this book?
Right. So that question is one I've been asked a lot in the last few months. And as I always explain, the roots of the actual book itself extend, again, a million years ago in sort of just after, the post 9/11 era began. So in 2002, effectively. So before I began doctoral research, before I went back to graduate school, I spent several years working on something wholly different from democracy programs. So I spent several years working on landmines. So I have a lot of expertise on landmines if I'm ever in a zombie apocalypse situation where I need to remove a landmine. So I spent several years working on humanitarian demining, so removing mines, landmines from countries around the world. Both in the State Department, the U.S. State Department, and then after that experience working for an NGO that was supporting the United Nations mine clearing programs throughout the world. So in that capacity, I was a program manager for landmine removal programs in Afghanistan, in Bosnia, Cambodia, Croatia, Mozambique, and Vietnam. And so that experience was transformative in a number of ways, particularly my experience working in Afghanistan in early 2002. So most folks remember, of course, that time both extremely tumultuous and also tremendously exciting in terms of, you know, thinking then about the possibilities for where Afghanistan might go. And of course, the situation today, you know, obviously completely depressing and wholly different from that time frame. But I was working on delivering or helping the UN's capacity to deliver money, in essence, like money to deminers who were doing important work throughout the country. And given what was going on at that time, there wasn't the formal ways that we might work were completely disrupted. And so part of my job when I was there for a few months was to figure out ways of getting these resources to people, deminers who needed them most. And you know, it was an exciting period. It was extremely eye-opening for me. It was the first time I had been to that country, the first time working with people with whom I'd only been in contact with by email. And I was enormously impressed by, you know, how locals themselves, right, Afghans who were, you know, running these programs and doing the actual work were you know, delivering, from the UN's perspective at least, extraordinary results. They were already doing that before the situation changed after 9/11, but it had the reputation in sort of my UN circles of the programs that we were managing anyway, of being the most effective, the most impactful, and the least corrupt. As well, which many people, I think, who might be, you know, have experience working in the developing world or maybe in that specific part of the world might be surprised by. But for me, it was a sort of, the takeaways were, you know, okay, you know, as most scholars of international peace know, that, you know, local peace building efforts, development programs tend to work best, not surprisingly, when locals are involved and engaged and guiding these programs. And so that was a key example of, okay, this is something that is working and is working really well. After that experience, I had already had an interest in going back into a research program and sort of trying to take that practical experience and sort of understand the theoretical implications, different directions that that research could take. And that brought me to graduate school. It brought me back to my long-term interest in the Middle East more broadly. And of course, again, this is post 9/11 era. This is also around the time that the then Bush administration was beginning to focus much more robustly, financially speaking, and aggressively, and I mean that in a tactical sense as well, on democracy aid programs. And so, again, this is my own interest in the Middle East at this time frame, my own interest in development, and, you know, a really a keen interest in what was going on in the mid-2000s, right? So at this time frame, the Bush administration was basically identifying democracy assistance as an enormous strategic priority in the post 9/11 era to tackle extremism and terrorism. And so the logic, you know, in a nutshell, is that, you know, we have more democracy, we'll have less terrorism, right? So we should spend much more money on democracy aid programs. Around this time frame, again, this is 2005, 2006, a very influential and important report that was commissioned by the U.S. Agency for International Development. Many people know it by its acronym USAID, and this is the primary agency in the United States that manages foreign aid. They had commissioned a cross-national quantitative study trying to assess the impact and effectiveness of its spending on democracy programs worldwide. Right. So it was an extremely sophisticated study. You know, I think it involved maybe something like 900 variables built into the study, trying basically to answer the question, does spending on democracy aid work? And, you know, many brilliant political scientists were involved as part of this project. They presented their findings at a meeting of the American Political Science Association that I attended as a graduate student. And I was, you know, blown away by sort of the scope of the project, but not unlike many many folks, I think, who were familiar with the study, also came away with many more questions about things that were missing from it, right? So the conclusion that the authors came to was that, yes, spending on democracy aid works. It seems to work everywhere except the Middle East, or basically, I think, if I'm remembering their words correctly, it works more in what they call difficult contexts, without elaborating on that, with the exception of the Middle East, right? So sort of my question, of course, is, okay, well, why isn't it working in this region, the region that I, you know, am familiar with and that I've spent a lot of time in? And also this, you know, seems strange given the enormous amount of funding that the United States had committed to democracy aid in the region. At that point, I was sort of, you know, in the beginning stages of putting together my own research and proposals for my PhD. And this is sort of what was just a puzzle that was fascinating to me that I couldn't let go. And I wanted to understand what was actually happening on the ground. And one of the striking things about this particular study is that, you know, again, extremely sophisticated. And with these sorts of studies, with a cross-national aggregate, you know, study of democracy aid, there's only so much you can capture in a study like this, right? But from my perspective and my own experiences in the development world, the actual politics of democracy aid wasn't in you know, a study. It wasn't reflected in a study like this, and nor could it be, right? This was sort of beyond the scope of what the authors are intending. And so I really wanted to see, you know, what was actually happening on the ground. How is this form of aid actually working in practice? So that's a very long story as to how I came about, you know, the doctoral research that would then expand into this book.
That's a fascinating trajectory. And it's actually a great segue into my next question, which is, can you tell us what sort of research you did for this book?
Yeah, so in the very sort of early, most naive stages of this book, I thought, okay, well, if I want to understand why this aid doesn't seem to be working, and I sort of, when I'm, you know, listeners can't see that I'm doing air quotes on this, but I am for their benefit. If we want to understand how this aid is working, if we want to understand why it doesn't seem to have much of an impact, well, then maybe the first starting point is that, okay, I will gather all the information I can on these programs, right? Just as a starting point to see what programs exist throughout states in the region, what kind of funds are being committed to these projects, who's doing these projects, right? So fundamental questions of, okay, what kind of projects are we talking about here? How much money is being committed by them? Who's actually doing them? How long are they implemented on the ground, et cetera? But finding that data was enormously difficult. It's not, as I note in the book, impossible, but it was very challenging. And also what I could find wasn't really telling me a lot. And so these were signals of, okay, there has to be more going on here. And so simply assembling data on what USAID has funded in the region isn't really illuminating here, right? So naturally, of course, you want to speak to the people that are involved. And so as the research would develop, you know, most of the research for this book focuses on democracy assistance in Egypt and Morocco. And I can talk more about my reasons for selecting both of those countries in a minute. But you know, in both of those countries, you know, it's not only thinking about what can I supplement to the data that I've already collected through online sources, through archival material, but how can I sort of flesh this out by talking with AID officials on the ground, by talking with program managers, by talking with recipients of this form of aid? And can I also talk with, you know, ideally, you know, representatives of recipient governments? So in this case, the U.S.'s counterparts in both the Moroccan and Egyptian governments. And also, what can we learn from looking at the practices of authors or of the actors that are engaged in this form of aid? In my own research over the last few years, I've been really, you know, inspired by completely influenced, of course, by development scholars who are not only looking at what's going on in the ground, but by scholars who have talked about the importance of looking at practices, right? So thinking about how people are doing things, the ways in which they are doing things, and what that can also tell us and illuminate about questions about impact and effectiveness. And when we talk about the practices of actors, we're talking about fundamentally ways of doing things, right? And these are things that you can pick up by looking at conference proceedings. So this is the archival research component of the book. Workshop proceedings that have happened in the U.S. government about democracy aid more broadly. Diplomatic cables, right? So how people are talking about things, both diplomats that deal with this democracy aid and also the practitioners that are sort of engaged with USAID's broader constellation of democracy aid programming. And then again, you know, pretty much straightforward, again, looking at the grassroots level, interviewing, talking with, spending time with people who have extensive experience on the ground with these programs. One of the challenges when you're looking at U.S. aid in the region or democracy aid in the region, and you are trying to understand maybe the government's perspective of working in this area, is that, you know, U.S. diplomats in both the U.S. embassies and in USAID missions are only there for 2 to 3 years, right? And so if you as a researcher are interested in sort of capturing the institutional history of this aid, you know, you have to dig a little bit deeper and try to also find people who've worked in those areas over time. And that was something that was important for me to do. So again, through sort of a snowball process for, you know, interviewing, you know, how can I find the people that have been working in this country over time. And so how can I piece these stories together to get a really nuanced understanding of the politics that have been involved with Democracy Aid, both from the donor government side, so in this case for the book, the U.S. government side, but also on the recipient actor side in Egypt and in Morocco.
That's very helpful. So in the book, you adopt what you describe as a political economy approach to studying democracy aid. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so I would identify myself as, you know, first and foremost, a scholar of development, but also a scholar of political economy. And political economy can mean a whole host of things to different people. But, you know, sort of the most basic understanding is how politics affects the economy and vice versa. And so for me and for what I'm interested in, if you want to understand how anything works, a political economy framework and a lens is enormously illuminating. And so a lot of my work has been very much influenced by some of the sort of giants in the field of political economy who've tried to understand or using frameworks in the study of political economy, how things like ideas, interests and institutions impact and influence the politics that we see just more broadly. So what that means in translation for my own work is that, again, I felt, as I mentioned at the outset, that I felt very frustrated by the direction of research on democracy promotion. So again, in the early 2000s, there was that USAID study that I mentioned, and a lot of our colleagues started doing extremely interesting work, again, in the same line of trying to understand how this form of aid is working. And again, I, you know, really appreciate some of the findings and the direction of that. But again, I wanted to, again, really understand how this aid was working on the ground. And so I also wanted to understand things, again, that maybe more quantitative approaches to democracy aid couldn't tell us, right? So how do these programs come into existence? How are they negotiated? How are they executed on the ground? What informs the conception or the ideas of democracy that are actually used in these programs, right? Because when we talk about democracy, for example, it can mean a whole host of things to everyone. And so to go back to your question, the part of trying to, part of understanding why this aid hasn't been as impactful or as effective as we think it might be, given the amount of money that's been expended for it, we can, I think, understand through a framework, a political economy framework, that thinks about how ideas, interests, and institutions that are engaged in this aid mediate and shape the actual form and construction of democracy aid in the region. So when I talk about ideas, I'm thinking, again, as I just mentioned, sort of how people are talking about democracy promotion, how they're talking about democracy aid, how they think this aid should work. When we talk about interests, we can think about the interests of different actors that are engaged in this form of aid. We can think about the incentive structures that govern, let's say, the individuals that work in the government, from the government side of things, both in the U.S. and in Egypt and Morocco, the incentive structures of contractors who are working on these particular kinds of programs. And we talk about the institutions that are engaged in this, too. We're thinking about broader institutional politics, not only just, you know, USAID, which is the primary focus in this book, or the respective governments in Egypt and Morocco. But we're also thinking about, I'm thinking about anyway, the foreign aid bureaucracy in Washington, D.C. Because, again, part of the story of understanding why this aid hasn't been impactful, you can only really understand and answer if you're paying attention to, not surprisingly, the domestic politics of what's going on in the United States, too. And that's an important backdrop for this book, which I talk about in the first couple chapters. And sort of understanding changes in the U.S. foreign aid bureaucracy with how foreign aid more broadly is managed, but particularly that subset of democracy aid as well, too. And this is something that researchers can, you know, can sort of think about. It doesn't have to be just from the U.S. side. It could be thinking about, you know, our friends in the U.K. with DFID, with other organizations elsewhere, and thinking about donor recipient state relations.
Right. So on that note, the book spends quite a bit of time looking at the foreign aid and democracy aid bureaucracy in the United States and how ideas about democracy developed over time right there. Can you give us sort of an overview of your findings on that?
Yeah. So again, this was part of the deep dive and trying to understand how it is we got to where we are today. And many scholars and analysts of Democracy Aid, of course, know that this isn't a new thing. It's not a new thing now. It wasn't a new thing even in 2004 when it was sort of the sexy area of focus of the Bush administration. This was aid that, again, has its, I mean, the roots of this form of aid arguably go back to the early 20th century and maybe even to the late 19th century. But it really began in earnest in the 1980s. Again, this is in the context of sort of the end stages of the Cold War. When we have the establishment of the National Endowment for Democracy. But it's really when we have sort of the dissolution of the Soviet Union that we start to see really the enormous spending and much more of a focus on democracy aid in the early 1990s. So again, in the wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union, a focus on what's going on in Eastern Europe. And there's a really thoughtful, you know, a thoughtful effort, I think, by many people that were working in the U.S. government to sort of say, okay, you know, we see this as sort of the vindication, this moment in history is sort of the vindication of our particular model of liberal democracy. And we also see this as an opportunity to sort of expand and develop programs that we think are important for supporting our form of democracy, right? So agencies like USAID start to put together conferences, workshops to sort of figure out, okay, we want to focus on democracy aid. We have all of this money to do so. So how do we do it? And what struck me in some of this work is, again, how thoughtful some of the ideas were. And so when I say thoughtful, I mean that we have, you know, clear evidence of, you know, folks within USAID reaching out to our colleagues in academia, you know, scholars who are experts on democratization broadly, but also experts on democracy in particular regions of the world. So in Latin America, Africa, in Europe, et cetera. And so there were a whole host of, you know, really detailed workshop and conference proceedings where these scholars were saying, you know, this is great that you want to do this, but here's also why you should be cautious, right? And here are some things you should pay attention to. And also here are some reasons why, you know, these things or these democracy programs are probably not going to work in the way that you think they're going to work. So some sort of warnings, again, from an academic perspective, that the process of democratization, not surprisingly for listeners of this podcast, is complex. We don't know exactly, we can't say with certainty how one country becomes democratic. There's a whole host of, you know, strong findings over the last three decades by political scientists saying maybe perhaps if we focus on economic reform, that's the best recipe for getting us to democracy. And that was certainly the guiding idea in the early stages of U.S. democracy programming assistance. But I was struck by, again, because I think it becomes, it's very easy for scholars now to be critical of the United States, and I certainly am in different capacities. But at this early stage, people were trying to learn as much as they could in a short period of time. And trying to do what they thought was best. But what we also see in this time frame, again, this is 1991, 1992 that I'm referring to. We start shifting to 1994 and politics in Washington, D.C. starts to change, right? So the Republicans begin to have more and more influence and control over the U.S. Congress. And things start changing within the foreign aid bureaucracy. So in general, democracy assistance has enjoyed enormous bipartisan support. So both Democrats and Republicans have been extremely supportive of democracy aid programs. And this has been pretty much a constant. The execution and the how, they sort of differ in some ways. But in general, it's one of the few areas, I think, in foreign policy where we can see strong bipartisan support for this particular form of aid. So while we have this sort of rhetorical enthusiasm for democracy aid, things start to change in Washington, D.C. And what I mean by that is that from the Republican sector of Congress, we have strong critiques about foreign aid in general. So Senator Jesse Helms, Newt Gingrich, and others, you know, have this line and mentality that, you know, basically thinks of foreign assistance as social welfare for developing countries, right? And, you know, they point to evidence of corruption with past USAID programs, sort of the evidence to basically shut the agency down in general. And I think it was Senator Helms who has some, you know, quote where he said if it was up to him, he would reform USAID out of existence. So again, on the one hand, you have this rhetorical enthusiasm for democracy promotion. At the same time, there are steps to basically sort of neuter USAID's work. USAID, as a result of what was going on during this time frame, was brought under the control of the State Department. I think in the process of restructuring, again, the foreign aid bureaucracy, maybe more than 1,000 development practitioners were sort of, let go from USAID. How AID worked in general started to change. So many listeners might know, of course, that the work of AID in the State Department is necessarily different. So USAID as a development agency is focused on long-term time horizons. And, our, colleagues, friends in the State Department are focused on short-term time horizons. And so naturally, we can appreciate that there's going to be some conflict in the conceptions of development work and how to do it. And so we start to see that coming up in the late 1990s. And we start to see the impact of what the changes are to the sort of neutering of USAID and the sort of, de-emphasis on or the sort of cultivation of development expertise. So the nature of USAID's work starts to change, not just for democracy aid, but for some of its other programs. So you don't see, again, sort of career USAID people in charge of programs or implementing them. We start to see that work contracted out to for and not-for-profit companies. And in some ways, they start to lose, USAID starts to lose control of who's doing what. And the incentive structure changes with some of these actors. And so one of the things that I found in my research, in some of the archival research that I had done, is that USAID was very concerned about the impact of these changes. And so naturally, you would think that a development agency, wants to know how its own work is being done, right? So after a project is done, they want to see a report showing what worked, what was great, et cetera. And so if a lot of the work is being contracted out, it becomes in some ways harder to get good feedback from a lot of the contracting organizations that are doing this work. And so some of those organizations were not incentivized to share some of the details of what they were doing. And so an audit that USAID had done of these programs basically said, look, one of the problems is that a contracting organization for this program doesn't want to share in detail what it's doing because it wants to maintain an advantage vis-a-vis other organizations with whom it's competing, right, for grants and projects. And this is, again, this is a tension that, has existed, again, since the early 1990s. But again, this is sort of connected to my bigger questions of, not only how things are working on the ground in the Middle East, but also what's going on in Washington, D.C. to change the incentive structure away from, again, thinking about how to support indigenous concerns, what, indigenous demands are for democracy, excuse me, and also thinking about how to make aid more responsive.
Wonderful. So after that analysis, you move on to examining two countries in the Middle East, as you mentioned, Egypt and Morocco. And you have this really great title for the Egypt chapter. It's called Neoliberalism on the Nile, which links up nicely with the title of the book, which is Marketing Democracy. And that's kind of a hint about your findings in that chapter. So what can you tell us about the ways that democracy aid evolved in Egypt?
Yeah, so Egypt was one of the sort of, model is a bit too much probably, but it was the key focus of the U.S.'s democracy efforts in the Middle East, right? So in this early period of the 1990s, when the agency is trying to think about what it wants to do worldwide for its democracy programs, Egypt, Indonesia, Nigeria, I'm forgetting the name of another country, but those were the countries that the United States wanted to focus on. Egypt was the focus in particular because it is, the biggest Arab country in the region. It has enormous influence in the Arab world, hugely important, as many listeners may know, for U.S. Security interests in the region. And so even at the early stages in the 1990s, there was a recognition that Egypt is important. We don't know how it's going to be important, but maybe we ought to start here.
And so how does democracy aid wind up evolving in that country?
Yeah. Yeah. So again, you know, in the early stages, we have examples of, you know, again, thoughtful approaches to understand the challenges to what was going on in Egypt. But one of the main questions, you know, motivating this book in general was not just trying to understand why this aid didn't seem to have much of an impact in the region or, you know, have much of an effect on democratization in general, was a more fundamental question that was really missing from most democracy aid scholarship, which is why would an authoritarian state even allow this form of aid? You know, it's a question that seems so obvious. You know, we think in some ways we've tackled it head on, but it was missing. And it obviously seemed hugely important in terms of understanding why this aid hasn't, you know, worked. One of the foremost scholars of democracy assistance, one of the earliest scholars of democracy assistance, Tom Carruthers, you know, tells us that, you know, this aid is intended to challenge the structure of power, ultimately, right, in any country, sort of broadly defined. So, you know, if you're dealing with a form of aid that's intended to challenge the structure of power, why would an authoritarian state, you know, allow it? So this is also a huge part of, you know, my sort of area of inquiry in this book. Essentially what I find is that, you know, not surprisingly, there are authoritarian states, or the ones that I'm studying in general, are getting something from it. So looking at what was going on in the early 1990s in Egypt in particular, and then of course later in Morocco, as I talk about also later in the book, tells us something about that. So, you know, the findings of the book are in general that U.S. democracy aid programs haven't done much to challenge the structure of power in the region. And by looking at what's going on in the field, and again, leveraging, you know, over a decade of field work and archival work on the Middle East or in the Middle East and Washington, D.C., I show basically that, you know, previous studies haven't really paid much attention to the fact that democracy aid programs are often negotiated deals. And this, I think, is significant for both the literatures on democracy aid and authoritarianism in general. So I show essentially that recipient governments can and do help craft the design of democracy aid programs. And this is, you know, intrinsically linked to that, you know, question of why aren't these working, right, in the way that we think that they should be working. And scholars of the Middle East who might be listening again, who maybe haven't read this book, you know, might think, well, of course, the answer to all of these questions is about security, right? And so there's lots of really great scholarship by colleagues in Middle East politics who've talked about, you know, how security concerns have sort of shaped democratization in general in the Middle East. And so this book and my findings, you know, definitely, you know, develop and back that up to a T. But I think, again, sort of illuminating why governments want to actually allow this aid and sort of their hand in this, I think is enormously important for, you know, not just understanding why things haven't worked, but also potential obstacles, not just in the Middle East, but also in other hybrid regimes around the world, other restrictive contexts where well-meaning donors, activists want to support democracy, but sort of have to be cognizant of the obstacles with that. So some examples from Egypt, just to kind of, you know, flesh out that point that I just made, is that in the early 1990s, again, you have well-meaning people from USAID. USAID has reached out to scholars of Egypt. So I talk about those scholars in particular in the book who are engaged with these projects, who put together, you know, very smart, astute analyses of what they think should happen in the region, or in Egypt in particular. And we, you know, I uncovered so many different stories of, you know, AID-sponsored democracy programs that wanted to, let's say, push elements of democracy program much more aggressively in Egypt that were basically diluted by the Egyptian regime. So one example in particular I talk about in the book is a civil society program that, you know, for most of us, if you would read the elements of this program would seem pretty banal. But from the Egyptian government's perspective, it was inherently threatening, right? It's something that is potentially challenging its authority in particular parts of the country. But this project, I think, in particular, was in Cairo. And the AID official who was working on this program was really pushing his counterparts and the Egyptian government quite hard in trying to realizing the aims of this particular project. And his counterparts basically were trying to shut him down. And so, again, when we think about what I mentioned before about the importance of strategic relationships, right, and sort of casting a particular direction on programs, we have, I think, one of the first early instances of this with this particular story in maybe 1994, 1995, where this AID official was frustrated that he didn't, in the end, didn't get support from his colleagues in AID. He said, look, I'm trying to do this program, but my counterparts in the Egyptian government, are making this impossible for me. Can you help me? Those Egyptian counterparts were also signaling to his superiors in AID of, we're not happy with this program. So let's figure out something, a different direction for the program. In the end, this particular gentleman was removed from the program because he was seen as, pushing too hard. And it was sort of, his sort of takeaway was that, I think one of his quotes was something to the effect of, well, it's Egypt, and Egypt is always going to get the money in the end. In other words, that the nature of the relationship between the U.S. and Egypt is such that they have leverage, basically, to say no to us, broadly defined, but particularly for these kinds of programs that, if the counterparts in the Egyptian government say this is going to be problematic for our relationship, the program is going to be bailed or diluted. And so we have another example by the end of the 1990s for a big civil society project for an NGO center that, was seen and had some support within the Egyptian government in the late 1990s. But we see that same dynamic where there's a great deal of resistance coming from counterparts in the Egyptian government, resistance from AID officials who are trying to strengthen this program, trying to work with civil society activists and getting this program started. And in this back and forth process that we see, again, this comes through interviews and archival work as well. We see basically that in this back and forth between AID officials and their Egyptian counterparts, the program objectives are significantly diluted down from the original objectives that AID officials had at the outset. So much so for this particular project, that some of the people that were engaged on it said, look, it effectively in the end did nothing. It began with good intentions. But one U.S. official who was very familiar with the project said, in the end, it became, actually, it was a more perverse consequence of the program. It became a way for the Egyptian government to sort of survey, to monitor civil society activists. So the sort of, empowerment angle of this particular program and the intentions of it completely disappeared as a process of that back and forth.
That's really remarkable. One of the things that I want to really underline for listeners is that, the book does a great job of bringing across how it is that the conception of democracy sort of shifts to more of a focus on economic reforms, and that this shifted focus also results in some cases in situations where it's actually the economic interests of the authoritarian regimes that are being rewarded. And so as a result, the democracy aid programs do not have democratizing results, right? Rather, they're sort of further reinforcing and strengthening these regimes. But I want to move to your other case, which is Morocco, where we see some of these dynamics play out as well. In what ways was democracy aid in Morocco similar to or different from Egypt?
Yeah, so there are a lot of similarities, and I'll just back up just a little bit and talk about why I chose to focus on Morocco and Egypt in particular. Egypt, as I mentioned earlier, again, was the early focus of USAID's efforts, has received some of the most significant funding from the United States for democracy programming. And I had already an interest in and spent time working in Egypt as well, too. So it was not only, that it worked out conveniently for me in the case that I wanted to choose, but I had spent a great deal of time in Egypt as well. Morocco I chose because I had also spent time in Morocco, but it was also one of the countries, both countries are two of the highest democracy aid recipients of U.S. funding in general since 1990. They are, of course, very different kinds of regimes, very different kinds of authoritarian regimes. Egypt until 2011, we would classify as a one-party dominant state. Of course, it's something very different now. And Morocco, of course, a constitutional monarchy, although most people who know Morocco, and the same could be said of Jordan as well, a constitutional monarchy may be a name only because essentially all power, you know, sort of rests with its king. So we have two very different kinds of countries, two very different kinds of types of regimes, and two countries who are important to the United States, but in very different ways. So Egypt, of course, much more of a bigger interest and focus for the U.S.'s geopolitical strategic interest in the region, although Morocco, you know, is also considered of strategic interest to the United States as well, too. So I was interested in sort of seeing again, you know, based off of the time I'd spent in Egypt, what was going on in Morocco as well, too, because in Morocco, you have something, a lot of very different dynamics that are going on. In some ways, there is more space for civil society, but you also see elements of civil society that are co-opted by the Moroccan regime, in the same way you see some elements of that in Egypt as well. The amount of funding is dramatically different, but we see some of the same dynamics that we see in Egypt, where, again, strategic interests are, in the end, responsible for diluting some of the focus of the democracy aid programs. In other words, U.S. officials not really ready to go the full mile for backing up some of these programs and really supporting civil society if they sort of cross a line that you know, that the Moroccan government, that the regime has sort of set for itself as well, too. But what we see in Morocco is something really interesting as well, too. So I talk about how, you know, recipient states, you know, do have some leverage, right, in the execution of these programs. And this is sort of something in general, I think, that we find in different kinds of restrictive states that receive democracy aid. But Morocco, in some ways, had some leverage in terms of having different patrons that it could play off of the United States. So Morocco has much closer trading relations with states in Europe, for example. So with France in particular, which most people wouldn't be surprised by, significant relations, right? With Spain, with the UK as well, too. And that came up in, you know, countless interviews that I had done, right? So if the US is going to be difficult with us, we always have the French, or we don't need your funding and resources. We always have this element or this other sort of card we can play. And this comes up, you know, or this sort of, like, I think leverage is exerted more forcefully after 9/11, right? So if we think about what the United States was concerned about after 9/11, this is something that recipient governments in the Middle East were quite savvy about, right? It's like, well, you need us. You need us for helping you with fighting terrorism and, you know, fighting extremism. And so we're going to ask that you not push us. In this case, I'm speaking of the Moroccan regime. We're going to ask that you not push us very hard on the democracy aid bit here, because you need us, right? And so this was something, a point of frustration that was echoed to me by Moroccan activists, Moroccan recipients of democracy aid, and also by USAID officials working in that country. And one of the things that I talk about in the book as well, when I've been mentioning that I, you know, spoke with the USAID officials in both Egypt and Morocco. But it's important to note that there are different kinds of officials, right? So there are Americans that come through in these missions, in these embassies. And there is something also in diplomatic parlance called local nationals. So these are Egyptians and Moroccans that are working within these agencies as well, too. And if you talk with them, you tend to get a longer institutional history of what's going on, because they've been working in these offices, you know, for, in some cases, decades. And so what I was told and what I remember from one Moroccan employee of USAID who's had been with these programs from the get-go is that, you know, a frustration with not only that, from his perception, the U.S. wasn't pushing hard enough in some areas, but also that the U.S. wasn't interested in or focused on other areas or conceptions of democracy promotion. And so one of the things that you and I have talked about a little bit in our time together is, again, that there are different forms of democracy. There are different ways of thinking about promoting democracy. And, you know, what we see in both Egypt and Morocco, you know, since the early 1990s, as sort of a common strategy, is focusing on economic reform. Right. And this reflected a lot of the academic literature that if we focus on economic reform, economic liberalization, then maybe that will, you know, help generate the conditions that might give rise to political liberalization. So not even democratization, but political liberalization. And this was in line with a lot of the efforts that were going on in both Egypt and Morocco to have their own economic reform programs, right, that were very much about moving towards moving more robustly towards a market economy. And so the thinking in the Democracy Aid offices is that this is what we need to focus on. One, because this is what the governments are doing already, right? And so if we have their ear on this, then maybe that's the strategy that we can sort of have a foothold, establish a foot in this area, with the idea that, you know, if things change in the country, if the governments become more receptive, then we can expand into other areas of programming, right? So even if we accept that, you know, this is not the correct strategy or approach, the strategy in the early 1990s in both countries was, let's focus on economic reform because this is what both governments are talking about. And this is, you know, maybe we can have an audience and an ear. But it became very clear from Moroccans in this case, and also in Egyptians, that this was problematic. Why? Because we know now that in many cases, well, in both cases, that elements of economic reform were being used by the regime to strengthen itself, right? So as the authoritarian state is sort of changing itself, adapting and responding to the economic situation, it's sort of using the tools that maybe we associate with liberalization and democratic reform to sort of strengthen the way the authoritarian state works. And Moroccans and Egyptians were very cognizant that this was happening. And they were also concerned with the quality of democracy being promoted in both countries, right? So, you know, if you're focusing on economic reform, if you're focusing on privatization as part of your democracy program, should you also not be concerned with the impact of these economic reforms on the quality of democracy in both states? And this is something that was enormously frustrating to both Egyptians and Moroccans that were working in the AID missions in both countries, because they were sort of, again, seeing the impact of these broader macroeconomic reforms and concerned, again, about the lack of a more nuanced understanding of what these reforms were doing and how they were impacting quality of life issues that were linked to democratization or the path towards democratization in both countries.
Now, we haven't really talked about the Arab Spring, but I want listeners to know that that's certainly something that you talk about in the book, right? You talk about the kind of impact that the Arab Spring had or did not have on U.S. democracy aid. But I'm going to jump ahead and ask you actually about policy implications. So what would you say are the policy implications of this book?
So there are a few. I think that many listeners might remember that it was just in December 2021 that the Biden administration launched what they called a Summit for Democracy. And it was sort of an effort in general to sort of jumpstart the thinking on democracy promotion, but also very much reflective of that administration, as well as the concerns of other governments elsewhere in the world about the expansion of authoritarianism. The sort of erosion of democracy worldwide. So sort of in 2021, thinking about big questions about what people can do in general. And so I've been thinking a lot about not only things that I've seen in the Middle East that are in my book, but also about what the U.S. government has been doing, how the U.S. government thinks about these things in general. And one of the things that was worrying to me when I was listening to some of the rhetoric in December of 2021, January of 2022, was this idea of, well, democracy is important. We should promote it and support it. And the discussions were more about more resources can we commit to this project, right? So we should do it. Yes, we should do it. It's important to do it. And we should devote more money to it. And this sort of line of thinking was deeply worrying to me, right? Because we can appreciate that there are some positive elements of democracy aid, a whole host of positive things that can come from these programs. But it's not a problem that can simply be solved by writing larger checks for these programs. And so one of the things that I've seen, in my own work, is that it's not that USAID or the State Department doesn't understand the problems from past efforts, right? One of the things that we haven't been talking about since 2021 is about sort of the source of the problems with democracy aid programs. And so there are lots of takeaways I hope people come away with from the book, but one of them is the need to really think much more thoughtfully about the foreign aid bureaucracy, right? How this aid is actually implemented and executed. Because again, it's not, writing a check for $20 million to Tunisia doesn't, immediately show an impact on Tunisia's democracy, right? We need to understand why this aid isn't working. So these sort of more foundational questions of like, how is this aid working? How can we maybe improve the execution of this aid so that locals, in the best sense of the word, have control over it, is something we need to be focused on. With the Middle East in general, and the chapter that I have at the end of the book where I talk about the Arab Spring, is important for a few reasons, because, in 2011, 2012, I was living in Egypt pretty much predominantly during that time frame. And I was really intrigued looking at what was happening and how exciting and euphoric those early stages of the uprising was in Egypt and, elsewhere in the Arab world. The big question of how is the United States in particular going to respond to this moment? And I talk about actually, a pretty big response, right? So USAID, says, acknowledges publicly, look, we haven't done well by Egypt and other states in the region. We haven't been listening to civil society as much. We haven't, we haven't allowed them to sort of be at the helm of these programs. Now is an important moment. Now is an important moment of change. And we're going to devote, if I'm remembering correctly, the amount was $60 million to help support what was going on in Egypt then. But again, just to underscore that it's not a problem that can easily be solved by just writing a bigger check. AID did that. But again, this is the challenge of working in a restrictive state. So I talk about the complexities of what was going on at that time, which is that AID came in and they said, we have this amount of money. They advertised the amount of assistance that was available for grants in Egyptian state newspapers, both Arabic and in English. And many people came, applied for these grants. But AID wasn't transparent in where that money was going, right? And this was a tension that I thought was really fascinating, because I went to some of these grant calls that AID had in Cairo at the time. And one of the things that was most worrying to me was, someone at one of these sessions, and it was a session of, how to apply for more assistance and what areas of assistance are you funding? Someone from a civil society organization asked, to whom have you given these funds? And they were asking because they just didn't want to replicate efforts, right? So if AID had already given its $20 million designated for civil society aid, they didn't want to waste the time applying for something in that area. And the AID official became really uncomfortable. And he was like, well, we don't want to share that information. We don't want to share that information. We don't want to share where that money is going. And this opened up the door. I remember sitting there thinking, this is going to backfire and this is going to be problematic. So, it raises lots of, questions about ethics and the execution of this aid. But the Egyptian government was still, all of the same actors that existed before 2011 were still very much, in government and in control at this time frame. And they, saw this basically as USAID interfering. They saw it as a form of subversion. And the fact that AID arguably maybe wasn't transparent about the process might have made things more complicated in the end. So, to circle back in a long way, back to your question about policy implications, I think this form of aid can be impactful, but I think without reckoning with sort of, again, how this aid, works at the source and the foreign aid bureaucracy, the chances for success, I think, seem to be limited to me.
And you also sort of conclude the book by talking about whether people in the aid bureaucracy need to be thinking beyond a narrow procedural definition of democracy as well. Now, obviously, we've only skimmed the surface of the content that's in the book, but we've taken up a lot of your time. So I just want to very quickly ask you, now that the book is done and out in the world, what is it that you're working on now?
Yeah, so I have a couple projects that, you know, has sort of evolved naturally from this project and sort of my continuing interest in the role of ideas in political economy and development. So I have the next sort of book project in progress is a post-Arab Spring book on the politics of transitional assistance in the Arab world and sort of looking at, you know, economic grievances that were sort of linked to the protests of 2011 and the politics of developmental assistance in general, sort of explaining in some ways why we're not seeing more liberalization or more promise in the Arab world today. Another project looks at the ethics of not only humanitarian aid, but also democracy assistance in general. And this, of course, you know, extends naturally from my own work and sort of understanding and wanting to, you know, answer the question, you know, is there an ethical way of promoting democracy, which I think is an important conversation for people that care about this aid to have. So those are the two big projects and another project on the role of lobbies, Middle East lobbies in Washington, D.C. as well.
Those all sound like great projects. And I hope you'll come back and talk to us about your second book when it comes
out. I'd love to.
So this book is Aaron Snyder's Marketing Democracy, The Political Economy of Democracy Aid in the Middle East, published by Cambridge University Press in 2022. Thank you, Aaron, for being on the show today.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed the conversation.
And thank you, listeners.